My name is Simon Cox. The date is the 30th of September 2009, and the time is 6:15 in the morning. And I'm interviewing on behalf of the Wellcome Trust. Can I firstly ask you to say your name, age, and where you've come from?
Yeah, my name is Andrew LeBence. I am 37, yeah, just about 37 still. And I'm from Chiswick in West London.
How long have you lived in Chiswick?
About 4 years. I moved there from Guildford. Before that, I was in Southampton. I was born in London, so it's kind of like coming home, really.
And what profession are you in?
I'm a journalist. I work in TV. I make the news on a daily basis. So I get involved with a lot of live television, meeting and setting up guests, working with pictures, working with lots and lots of people and technical staff and editorial staff. I have a laugh.
And how did you get into this career?
I started out, I guess, it must have been about 10-15 years ago. I was living out in the States at the time, taking a year out after I'd been through university. And while I was over there, I got involved with a local radio station over there, just on a purely voluntary basis. It's like an intern. And I thought, you know what, this is rather good fun. You know, just spinning a few discs, as it were, and a bit of jaw into the microphone. And when I came back to the UK with the expiration of my visa, I thought, okay, well, I've kind of got a taste for something I quite enjoy doing. So how do I go and take it on to the next level? And I kind of wanted to tie in because I had a general appreciation of current affairs and news and that kind of event. So I took a postgraduate course in broadcast journalism. Got involved doing that, found that then as a useful way of kind of putting the foot into the door. You know how it is in the media world, if who you know is everything, and getting your that initial foot in the door is the crucial thing that you have to go and do. So I finally kind of used that as a launch pad, got myself into a job in a pretty appalling, it has to be said, little independent local radio station. I won't name them. But I then, that it turned from one thing to another. I got a freelance job working for the Beeb, then in local radio, and kind of, moved from one local radio station to another. Finally I ended up getting my proper full-time staff job that I now have. And then I decided to take the kind of plunge, move from radio into television. As, it's a slightly different discipline, it's a different medium, a whole different way of doing things. You work in the media, so you'll be familiar with the whole concept of Lord Privy Seal. So trying to get my head around that was in the early stages quite a challenge, quite an accomplishment. I've been doing that now for 8-10 years or so, and I'm gearing up now. I've got a big program that I'm working on, which is going to be a big event for next year, and I love it.
So what does your day-to-day activity actually involve?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, the Beeb has got a huge array of outlets to go and cater for. So it kind of depends which outlet I'm working on any particular day. If I'm working, my standard job is working in 24-hour television news, and I tend to do a lot of work actually in the gallery, which is the kind of the big control room where you see pictures of television being made. The gallery is the room that's full of all the monitors, and where the vision mixer and the sound mixer and the director all sit and start talking and chin-wagging to the presenters through talkback and so on. And I work generally in the gallery, but I'm on editorial staff, so I'm kind of involved with deciding the running order and physically determining the news agenda on any particular day that the program is then going to output, and then physically outputting the program, live as it happens, seeing what's going on, and effectively dictating what people who are sat at home, potentially around the world, are physically watching. And my kind of my opinion is then what the channel as a whole is taking, and the direction I'm determining the direction of the channel, which is quite a responsibility, but quite good fun. And that's my normal job, and I'm involved also in manufacture of graphic elements particularly as well. I mean, television is not just about pictures, but there are a number of graphics as well, just an explainer something to help ease the understanding of what's going on. So I get involved with making some of those as well. And then currently I'm involved in a much, much bigger project, which is gearing up towards next year. And we're expecting the big event, which is the general election, to go and happen on May the 6th next year, on or around May the 6th next year. Obviously, it's entirely up to the Prime Minister to go and put that particular balloon up and start and fire that particular starting pistol. But I'm currently working on making that programme, as it's a key moment in British history, but for my employer, it's an absolutely crucial element anyway.
Can I just pick up on something you said? You mentioned that obviously you have editorial sort of
control
over particular news, what news is broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to ask, because obviously it's down to, and I imagine some other members of the team, but what criteria do you go by?
That's a really, really quite difficult question to answer, because no two stories are ever quite the same. Sometimes I'm looking for a story which has got a shock value or a wow factor to it. Sometimes it's a story that is just slightly off the wall, human interesty. It just kind of jumps off the page as being blindingly obvious. I mean, nobody in their right mind would for a moment start to suggest that the tragic events of 9/11, for example, were not major news events that you shouldn't go and cover straight away. Those are they are no-brainers in terms of what you have to go and do. I guess that the real complication comes when you've got what we kind of consider to be the middling news agenda stories. How do you balance up these stories and decide that one of them is slightly more important than another and therefore determine the priority? And often the case it's just a little bit about what we know our audience likes. We obviously have a lot of audience research in terms of the sort of stories they want to hear and they like to hear, so we can kind of accommodate those stories. But also just how different it is, how newsy it is.
I'm just wondering, do you wonder from a personal perspective if there is any bias in the news in general?
Bias in the news in general? Yes. Yeah. Well, again, it depends on the medium and the media. I mean, clearly there's bias in, for example, the newspapers. They all have political affiliations. The broadcast media is meant to be a lot more politically neutral, although clearly I think it's a fairly fair thing to go and say that the BBC is probably slightly more left-facing than Sky, for example, which is much more right-facing. But in terms of other bias, we get criticised quite a lot for our bias one way or another, to either the Israeli cause or the Palestinian cause, or the Indian cause versus the Pakistani cause. Bias is a really, really subjective kind of thing, because if a story is being told in any way at all that is a story that you either don't agree with or a position that you don't agree with, then you naturally assume that it's because there's some kind of bias just a leaning away from your particular point of view. All we have to can do and try to do is to portray as many points of view as we possibly can. And the nature, unfortunately, of broadcast television news is that generally you can only you can only put out one point of view at any one time. And if somebody is not then waiting for that other point of view to come across, they only ever really hear one side of the story. So yes, it could be argued there's a sense of bias there, but it's not intentional.
Just to turn our attention to the plinth,
Yep.
How did you first hear about the project?
It was actually a news story. There I was sat in the gallery, and we were doing a bit of a feature all about it. And I remember seeing an interview with Anthony Gormley about it at the time, and the call going out, you know, volunteers wanted to go and man this thing. I thought, hey, that sounds like, you know, just a stupid, crazy thing to go and do for, you know, it's an hour of time after all. So I went and I put my name into the hat, not expecting a thing. And sure enough, you know, I went through a couple of ballots and I just got a rejection email, say, sorry, not successful this time. And, you know, the project was starting to draw into a close, because obviously it's only running for a portion of the summer anyway. And then all of a sudden in the inbox one day, congratulations, you won a spot. And I thought, oh crap, what do I go and do while I'm on it now? You know how it is, you know, you go and buy, you know, I suppose the analogy for me was you go into the shop to go and buy a lottery ticket, and you know, actually there's no chance in hell of ever actually winning it, but you go and buy a ticket anyway because of the whole what if kind of motivation. And I guess that's a little bit how it was here as well, you know, kind of entered it, you know, expecting to be you know, just among thousands of people in this general ballot, but on this particular occasion my number came up, and here I am.
And what do you plan to do with your time in the plant?
Well, I'm a great fan. Outside of my working environment, I'm an instructor for scuba diving. I qualified as an instructor earlier in the year, and I've been scuba diving on and off for 20 odd years. So, you know, it's kind of a big part of my life outside of work and my social life and who I am. So I just thought, I'm never going to get a better opportunity than this to go and try scuba diving in somewhere slightly unique. I'm never going to get a better opportunity than this to go and stand on a plinth. And hey, it's in Trafalgar Square as well. So, you know, this is kind of ticking all the boxes one after another. So my plan is to go and try and dive in a drive suit on top of the plinth in Trafalgar Square, because it's there.
And how exactly are you going to go about this?
Yeah. Well, I've got the suit here. I'll put that on. I've got the rest of the kit. I had to go and make a cylinder. I decided that standing up on the plinth for an hour carrying a 20 or 30 kilo cylinder was probably not a good idea. So, you know, in the best traditions of Blue Peter, I made one slightly earlier. So a little papier-mâché thing to keep me going. And I'll just be up there with my mask, my regs in my mouth, and see what happens, really.
And how did you initially get involved in scuba diving?
How did I get involved in that? It was a family holiday, actually, back in the very late 90s, down in Cornwall. It was on one of those kind of holiday camp sort of holidays. With my family, and there was an opportunity to go and give it a go in a swimming pool, you know, just a straightforward have a try, see what you think. And I went in, and you know, it was only a very, very shallow pool, you know, a couple of feet deep, and I kind of just clicked straight away. You know, I came out and just felt like, you know, I'd taken it to this like a fish to water. And not unsurprisingly, the guy who was instructing me, you know, ever quick on the ball in terms of trying to, you know, cash in on a few more things, said, well, you've made a you've done the bit in the pool, why not go and try it in the sea as well? Just go and see how different that is. Obviously, down in Cornwall, the water's nice and warm, the sun was up, so I went and dived down on a reef down there, because there are reefs around the UK, and it was about a 10-metre dive, and it lasted for about three quarters of an hour, maybe just over. And you know, just open up a whole new world. There's a great big world down there waiting to be explored. I mean, we've climbed up mountains and we've gone through forests, but you know, so we've explored as a species much of the land there is out here, but we've explored just a fraction of the sea, and it's just incredible to go down there and see it all. There's such a myriad of life. It's incredible. Color, atmosphere, everything about it, you know, it's just pure escapism. And so I followed that up in the following year with taking a proper qualification, so I became certified then as a diver, And then I just worked my way up through the ranks, doing a bit of diving here and there. And now I'm the instructor, so it's now my turn to kind of pass on the knowledge that I was given first time to somebody else and give them that first introductory experience.
So have you been able to travel and experience scuba diving elsewhere?
A little bit. I was in Australia about 18 months ago, and so, you know, if you're out in Australia, it would be criminal, just criminal, not to go and dive on the Barrier Reef. So I went and dived out there. And in many ways, actually, I was slightly disappointed by it all. I mean, it's there's been a lot of commercial diving going on over there, and you know, diving is an industry out there. And as a way, it was slightly depressing because the reef had taken a bit of a battering as a result. And you know, you'd swim around some of the sandy bottom, and you'd see broken off bits of coral or whatever, and that was actually slightly depressing. Although, you know, there was still plenty of, obviously, loads and loads of other stuff down there. You know, swimming with sharks and swimming with turtles was great fun. But it was nonetheless slightly disappointing to go and see that so much of, you know, what the Barrier Reef was all about, the reef itself, had been kind of destroyed by just clumsy diving, to be brutally honest. But that was great fun otherwise. And then in terms of other places I've dived, I tend to keep going back to, there's a place over in Brussels, it's the world's deepest swimming pool, it's called Nemo, and it's 34 metres deep. It is a 34 metre deep swimming pool, and it's the only place you can go in the world and dive to that depth without ever actually going outside, which is, you know, just a curious thing to go and do. It's a great fun place to go. And then loads of dive around the UK, love diving in the UK. I was up in the Farne Islands, Northumberland. When there's no, is it Northumberland? Yes, it must be in Northumberland. It's very close to the Scottish border. That was a month ago, and there are seals up there. And you know, every dive we were going, I was diving with seals, and looking at the corals and everything else is up there. And then just this last weekend, I've been in Weymouth, and there's some loads of wrecks to go and see in around Weymouth. Obviously, the UK, we've got a massive maritime history, so wrecks live everywhere. And so had a bit of a wreck fest down there, and some scalloping as well.
And what kind of culture is there surrounding scuba diving?
Drinking culture, usually. it's just a drinking culture, basically. It's a great big experience and a chance to go and have a bit of a knees up as well. It's a fun thing to go and do.
And how do you teach people?
In a fun way, hopefully. People come into diving are one of two kinds. They're either really, really gung-ho and really mad for it and up for it and want to go and experience it, or they're a little bit apprehensive because they've kind of been pushed into it by, you know, pushy parents or a pushy partner or whatever, and they're really not quite sure about the whole idea of being underwater for that length of time and just having a little tube to an air tank. I just smile. It works wonders, and it's usually the case, 99 times out of 100, that people will then come up having taken that first couple of breaths underwater and just go, wow. Just go, wow. And then you know you're on to a winner straight away. And the rest of the course becomes very, very straightforward, very, very easy.
And how do you feel once you see that sort of expression on some of your trainees' faces?
Oh, it's a really, really, really uplifting kind of experience. I mean, I never wanted to get into teaching, but, either professionally or in diving. But it's a really, really uplifting experience because, well, you know how it is, you always remember, you know, some of your primary school teachers or your really, really important secondary school teachers and so on. You've always got, you know, a favourite or one that sticks out in your memory. And, you know, that's what being a teacher is all about. And here is another example of, you know, I'm going to be a teacher, and in exact the same way that I still have really, really kind of positive memories of my first diving experience. So hopefully other people are getting positive memories and a good memory of their first diving experience. And that's a really kind of uplifting and great thought to think that, you know, you're just kind of helping to shape the way some people are looking on their lives.
Just to take you outside of scuba diving, what other interests do you hold?
It tends to my life generally tends to revolve around current affairs and news and diving, and well, more than quite occasional drinking, to be brutally honest. No, I just try to have a laugh, you know. I go and see my friends, go and do stuff, you know, nothing kind of memorable or anything like that, just have a laugh, meet people, go places and do things.
And one final question, this project's all about getting a modern portrayal of Britain, so I'm going to ask if you can to describe or paint a picture of yourself generally in this moment of time.
Paint a picture of myself. I'm 37 years old, I'm single, and I'm a homeowner, and I live in London, and I have a job, and I'm pretty grateful for all those things.
Thank you.